regularly scheduled press conference, and I'd like to name a lot of the guys who on our side of the shop did a good job. Simple problems like today when we were working this, essentially the rendezvous problem between the vehicles, took a tremendous amount of people. This type of problem is one that we use, or actually the type problem we solve, whether it be a network problem, through, I guess what you could call teamwork. In all the missions we run, we've had some outstanding demonstrations of this type of teamwork. Very early in the game, we had problems with the S-4B downlink. Prior to the unmanned burns, we couldn't process it. And the people up at Goddard came up with a new program in real time that they read out to the computers, and we were able to process the downlink computer data with about 1 hour's delay. That was an outstanding job done. Communications, if you remember, we had communications problems in the third day of the flight. By the time the fifth day of the flight came around, they got licked. That was another outstanding job done by the network controllers here in Houston, the communications people around the world, and again Goddard. The baseline of all the information we use is processed by the Mission Planning Analysis Division. They give us a tremendous amount of work. We have an auxiliary computing facility that does the bulk, or a good bulk, of the retrofire work that John Llewellyn actually uses in his job. Program office. We've got what we call the SPAN team back, representatives of all the manufacturers and our engineering people that provide us vast amounts of engineering information that we use to track down these various problems we get. So across the board, I think we've had a pretty good mission so far. We've still got a ways to go to get the crew recovered. But again, I'd like to thank publicly all of the people that carried the load and allowed us as flight controllers to get the job done. Now, throughout the most of the early part of the day, I was working with the retrofire people in going over the various landing areas, weather, that type of stuff, in addition to working with the flight dynamics people in this tracking task we came up with. And during that period of time, I generally hand the job over to the assistant flight director, Chuck Lewis. So I'm going to let him recap briefly the first 4 hours of the shift today, and then I'll pick up the last four.
Okay, flight team picked up on Rev 134. And we gave a go for the 152-1. We advised the crew on the service module RCS configuration we wanted. In particular, we were interested in switching over to our so-called Volkswagen tanks on the service module RCS. We thought we would do that early today, but as our shift ended, we had not yet made our switch over. On Rev 135, lapse time about 213 hours. Most of that orbit consisted of photography, and we started our SO. The crew unstowed and installed the cameras for SO-65 experiment. And we took photographs Wilmington, North Carolina, on SO-65. Rev 136, again, is primarily photography. And more on SO-65, Southwest United States and Georgia. On Rev 137, the crew expended all of the SO-65 film, stowed the cameras. And there we performed our COASA calibration check. And that was it for about the first 4 hours. During that time, I think Gene was working with Fido on the possibilities of tracking the ascent stage later in the day.
You know, when we picked up, the crew had essentially the only major item remaining in the flight plan. The scheduled flight plan was the P-22 landmark tracking, which we used a slightly different procedure for today. And I think, as you heard, the crew was supposed to track the western tip of Haiti, and apparently he tracked as a landmark portion of the main island of Haiti, and we're going to have to backtrack from the data he gave us, the latitude and longitude of the marquee tracked, and determine how well that particular task was performed. And in addition, we had now we set the crew up and gave them about 4 hours to start getting their equipment stowed and cleaning up the spacecraft for the reentry tomorrow. However, there were two more things we wanted to do. We wanted to do some more experimenting with what we call PTC, which is passive thermal control, and it's a technique we use for thermal management of the spacecraft on the way to the moon. And while the crew was stowing the spacecraft, we asked them to set the spacecraft up in PTC attitude. And each rev, we ran three revs in this mode. Each rev, we changed the dead bands that we allow the spacecraft to control within. First rev, we did it at plus or minus 10 degrees. Second rev, plus or minus 20. Third rev, at plus or minus 25. As soon as we finished that, we gave the crew the cryo plan for the evening, and then proceeded to update the spacecraft with the appropriate vectors, both the command module and the LEM vector for this tracking task we ran, which was successful over Hawaii. And that was on Jerry Griffin's ship, the gold team, which is on right now, and we just stayed over until they finished that job. And that's basically about it. I think you're aware we also selected 152-1 as the prime landing area, and I think that got out to you very shortly after we made the decision this morning. That's all I have. Now, I have more data on the ascent stage. This tracking task we did, since I'm sure you'll probably ask a question. The acquisition we had predicted to be somewhere around 222 hours and 39 minutes. Now, you may have acquired earlier than this, but this is the time I'd guesstimate right now, because he was over Hawaii at this time, and we saw him move into the P-20, Program 20, and go through his acquisition procedures, lock on, and then start marking. At this time, he was at a range of about 600 miles behind him and about 400 miles below the LEM, and he was also off to the left, it looks like, about 200 miles. He apparently tracked for up to about 7 minutes before the spacecraft or the LEM was somewhat obscured by the Earth background, and then he apparently tracked intermittently for about 4 minutes thereafter. The point of closest approach was at 222 hours, 41 minutes, and 46 seconds, and the range at that time was about 652 nautical miles, still behind. The LEM was still behind the, the CSN was still behind the LEM. And we're about, I'd say about 300 miles below. And he was just crossing over at that point. He was essentially right along the flight path of the command and service module. And I don't know what the LOS range was. We asked him to give us this data. And that's about it from a standpoint of the tracking task. I'm sure we'll have more on that. It'll probably take until the crew gets down before we can do any more analysis on it. I have it. If you want to, 3,741.7 by 127.8. And the period is 2 hours and 45 minutes. The CSM orbit at the same time, if you want it, was 245.0 by 98.0.
Good. What range would that have been acquired?
Like I say, we really don't know. I'd say they may have picked it up visually up to about 700 miles. We really can't tell. We know at Hawaii that he moved almost immediately at acquisition into Program 20, and he very shortly thereafter marked on it.
Go ahead, Tom.
Jack, can we get into, Gene, can we get into now that the sequence of events and decisions that led up to the decision to go to 252-1 this morning?
Sure, I wasn't.
And where the ship is and where it's going now, et cetera.
Okay, John, you may have some later data on that. We came in this morning and had a weather briefing around Pete Frank, who's the night shift flight director of the Orange Team and who will be handling the recovery. Started reviewing the weather around 4 o'clock this morning, I believe is when he got his first update. We had set up a meeting for 7 o'clock, and I'm trying to find a piece of paper here in camp. For 7 o'clock, at which time it appeared that the Area 151 was clearing, as had been forecast yesterday, But we still had 10 to 12-foot swells and waves of about 6 feet and 23-knot winds. It was also apparent that 152-1 was significantly better. The winds were light and variable, the swells 6 to 8 feet, and the waves 2 to 3 feet. I think as we identified yesterday, we had to make up our minds somewhere around 10 o'clock this morning, 10 or 11, which direction we wanted to move the carrier. And I'd say around 8 o'clock, Chris and George Lowe came in, and we had gotten the recommendation from the recovery people and essentially decided to go 152-1. I'd say it was roughly around 8 o'clock. I don't know the specific time.
Gene, if I could follow that, why couldn't you have moved 151 uprange or downrange, or for instance, by firing the deorbit a few seconds before or later, or by lift?
Well, I think John can answer this better, but I think what you really had to do is to move to the south, because it apparently the entire area north of about 30 degrees, or in the area of about 30 degrees, was still under the influence of this weather that was causing the high swells and the reasonably high winds. But, John, you can say why you can't move it back uprange.
Roger, I think you've got it just about right. The weather was westerly, the weather was moving, the worst weather was moving in a westerly direction. And, of course, you don't want to get too far back up towards the Cape. So this is where we keep it at. And like we said yesterday, we were good and clean in the 152nd round. So we decided this morning we wouldn't lose anything by going in there. And essentially that your weather, the 10 to 12 foot swells and the crosswinds were the reason that we decided not to go in there.
Do you have any updated times for the major events in the reentry sequence?
Yes, sir, I do.
And if we want to get
into that. Yeah, why don't you give those now?
Okay, in terms of GET, that's ground elapsed time, retrofiring that is 240 hours, 31 minutes and 30 seconds. If we have a 400K foot time of 240 hours, 44 minutes and 23 seconds. And that's at a latitude of 32 degrees, 55 minutes north, 98 degrees, 19 minutes west. And that's, pictorially, you can see it on the map. 05G is at 240 hours, 46 minutes, and 52 seconds. Begin blackout, 240 hours, 47 minutes, and 21 seconds. End blackout is 240 hours, 50 minutes, and 45 seconds. Drogues, 240 hours, 55 minutes, and 4 seconds. Main chute is 241 hours, 55 minutes, and 50 seconds. And then landing time is 241 hours and 41 seconds. I've tried to, after yesterday, I've tried to put,
so,
sir, 241 hours. Go ahead.
Get a mic.
John, you jumped from 240 hours, 50 minutes, 45
seconds.
I'm
sorry, that should be. The main chute should be at 240 hours. That was a mistake. I read it wrong. The main chute is 240 hours, 55 minutes, 50 seconds. The landing time is 241 hours, 00 minutes, and 41 seconds.
Kind of a burn you're looking for,
sir. We're burning approximately 350 foot per second for 11.5 seconds. Total burn time, 11.5.
Do you have the time of separation of the command module from the service module?
Yes, sir. We have to be separated by 240 hours and 34 minutes.
Would you repeat that?
240 hours and 34 minutes.
Would you repeat the time? 11
and a half seconds.
Mark?
I have a question about a question McDivitt asked you people this morning about Quad A. And he indicated that he couldn't understand why Quad A was never used or very rarely used because it was the one you had to use most
for a SPS, rather a RCS deorbit, and you people came back and said, no, that wasn't the one. McDavid got it backwards like I'm getting it now, basically what it was. And basically, I was curious how a man can go through all this training and not really know that Quad A is the one that he has to use for RCS deorbit.
First of all, I'm sure he understands what quad he's supposed to use. I think, and here I go over my head right now. From a standpoint of system management, the technique you use for deorbit determines which quads get the most use. In other words, SCS will use an entirely different set of quads for pitch control than the digital autopilot one. Okay, and it's just due to the technique that the SCS uses as opposed to the digital autopilot uses in controlling. Now, this is going to vary as a function of CG of the spacecraft and many other things. This is why the quad management itself is such a problem. Because all of our red lines, the numbers we use are different for each quad. And it differs as a function of the weight of the spacecraft and the control system we use for reentry. Now, to go any beyond that is well over my head, and I should have Neil Hutchinson or one of those guys here. But it's a relatively complex problem, and all of the innuendos as to which quad you use on what day is very difficult.
Go right there, then get John Lannan back.
A quick one. At this time, there's no question in your mind that you will have to use the RCS deorbit. Is there any?
The SPS is go.
The SPS
so
is go.
I have no... let's put it this way. I see no reason why we should use an RCS deorbit. We have the margins we need for RCS deorbit. By moving to the 152-1 landing area, we would have to move our RCS deorbit landing areas now into the Pacific. So our secondary areas are now in the Pacific for RCS deorbit.
Gene, seeing as this is the last go-around before the splash, would you like to summarize for us a little bit the things which we aren't likely to pick up out of this mission on the surface? In other words, we're aware of the LEM success and the total flight. But from your point of view as flight controller, what are the things that have really kind of turned you on about it?
I'll tell you what, if you ask some other question, give me a few minutes to think about it, I'm sure I could do a better job and give you a more reasonable answer, because that's a pretty difficult question to answer.
Here's a nice, minute one, Gene. Will there be a line on the wall clock, on the countdown clock, which shows the time from deorbit to splashdown, counts down in minutes and seconds to that? And which line?
Yes, we generally do have one. We have one counting down to retrofire, and then we have one counting in elapsed time from retrofire. We generally don't count down to splash. Aren't most of your displays, John, set up in elapsed time since retro?
That's affirmative.
Will you have one this time? Will you not have one this time then? You'll have none counting down from deorbit to splash.
We could set one up. We have a spare clock, but generally, like I say, all of our displays, and we think in event time from ignition to splash. In other words, it's a plus time count as opposed to something counting down to splash.
Well, ABC would love you if there is a line
okay,
on the clock which counts down.
We'll make sure that we get one that's counting down.
Is this, wait a minute, see if we understand this. Is this total lapse time?
Yeah, what he wants, John, is to get a clock set up for delta time. Do you want it in minutes to go and seconds to go? What he wants to do is to sync a clock at TIG to count down to splash. We'll use the upper RTE to count down. Okay, and the other one will count up.
Nelson, Ben.
What he wants, John, is a coincidence
okay.
at ignition. Okay, such that one of the RTAs will count down to zero at the same time we hit the water.
Okay.
Remind me of that.
Gene, today about between 11:30 and noon our time, RCA's communications and the National Bureau of Standards detected a solar flare. Did that cause any problems with communications, and do you know anything about dosimeter readings as a result thereof?
We have a full-time activity going in the what we call the span area. It's what space radiation is call sign in there. They did did not advise us of any incidents that would cause us to either alter the flight plan or want to take any precautions today. Now, they have a set of ground rules that they work within, more or less warning limits that, as a function of magnitude of the flare, that type item, they give the flight director and the flight operations team a warning. Generally, we operate on negative reporting in the control center, and I'm sure that it was not of such a magnitude that it would cause us to take any unique action.
Go ahead. Three short ones. Can you refresh us on the temperature in the shock wave with this reentry profile? Second, if we do an RCS deorbit into the Pacific, can you tell us about what rev and about what where the landing would be? And third, have you had any private conversations with the crew today?
Okay. I'll answer the last first. No private conversations since the last private conversation, and we didn't have any today or yesterday or the day before, to my knowledge. I really don't know, but you were aware of it.
Came on the gold team shit.
The other two, John, do you know what the temperature in the shock wave is? That's sort of out of my...
I used to know.
It's interesting. John was one of the big thermal guys in Langley when we picked him up many years ago in Mercury. He was worried about
his
shields at
that
time.
Might even hazard to guess what it is. It's pretty hot.
You want to talk about 155-4?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have present backup for the RCS. The rev that we'll come into is 155-4. That's essentially by Hawaii. It's 16 degrees west, about 23 degrees north. And the present time for that is about 246 hours.
Jim?
I think I'm asking John Lannon's question a different way. Assuming a normal reentry tomorrow, what percentage of your objectives will you have completed? And are there any that you didn't get out of the mission that you would have liked to have gotten? And
what else? I had another one under it. Yeah. Oh, and what did you get kind of as a bonus like this line? What did you get?
Well, that's a hard one to answer, too. I'd say there's only about one item left that I would have liked to have gotten, and I'm sure we'll pick it up on that, and that's some of the lunar communications modes. If you remember when we came up on the systems test day, we were behind in the timeline, and that's one of the items that we had to scratch. I think there were three different modes we wanted to test. To my knowledge, all of the other items in the flight plan have been accomplished, with the exception of those three. Now, some of the free bonus dividends we've gotten out of the mission, we've done a large amount of work in passive thermal control, which is important to the FNG missions. We've got some idea that I think we can extrapolate out as to the fuel consumption required in passive thermal control and some of the techniques we need to exercise for thermal control. From a standpoint of landmark tracking, we've been doing a yaw roll type maneuver as opposed to a pitch maneuver that, again, we feel will help us significantly in our lunar landmark tracking because with the lower moments of inertia, we use less fuel and we feel we can track better possibly. So we, I think, learned that out. We did several backup alignments and used several of our backup alignment techniques yesterday particularly. I personally am not familiar with the results, how well they went, except for the fact that apparently the crew was satisfied with them, and we did that on several occasions. I think you're aware we've done some tracking on various satellites. Today was the one that I was really looking for, and that was to use the onboard computer and take a look at an object way out. Conceivably, you could say that information might be useful in a limb rescue case. You got some idea as to at what range rates you can track that type of information. It's just good information to have. We may be able to use it. We're not sure. We did some backup COAS work. COAS calibration, and we found out that apparently you were quite repeatable in being able to remove and reinstall the COAS and still get repeatable results out of it. And I'm sure there's many others because we've been doing a lot of more or less ad hoc testing as the opportunities presented themselves for the last 5 days. I think I've hit the major items. I'm sure there's more, however. I think one of the other items that I think was a free bonus dividend, it was originally planned. I think we got some good data from the S4B restarts we made also.
Gene, at some point this morning, it was Capcom or PAO said that the Guadalcanal needed about 16 hours to get to the 152-1, and it looked like that was about 15 hours from splashdown time. What time will the ship get to the target area?
Gee, I really don't know. Just to show you how far off I was last night, if you remember, I said that we'd have trouble getting there, and I found out only today that when I went and talked to recovery, it was no sweat. So I guess I best tune in and pay more attention when they're talking.
I think it's about 4 hours.
About 4 hours.
About 4 hours
for a splash.
I don't know. They were at 137-1, wherever that was, 68 degrees west. What are they?
It was about halfway between 151 and 152. I talked to the carrier a couple of hours ago, and they were already in noticeably smoother water, and they didn't, and they were all didn't have any problems getting there in the morning. John?
To go back to my earlier question, Gene, what about operations in the control room? Do you have any better feel for handling?
I'm still writing down.
Okay.
Can you belay that a bit more and see if there's any other? Because that's one of that was the third item that I had just written down.
Why are the astronauts coming directly back with just that fueling stop at the skid strip? Don't they usually stay over at the Cape for a couple of days debriefing?
They didn't on 8, if you recall, and the plan on this was to come into Norfolk and come straight on back to Houston. So this is not a change.
Is that to satisfy the Chamber of Commerce, which regularly will protest
AFC? I don't know. Go ahead.
Bernie. Two questions. The first, does the command module still go to Norfolk the way it was supposed to?
I believe it will, but I'm not sure. I'm sure Jack's probably got more information on that.
We don't. Have we got word on that yet? Okay.
Both the MQF and the CM will stay on the Guadalcanal and go in and off of.
I understand that.
And also, could somebody please tell me some of the bad things that might have happened to the crew and the command module and the recovery forces if you had attempted to land at the nominal landing area?
That's sort of a question you're asking me. let me turn the question around. As far as I was concerned, the weather was suitable in both places, but I saw no reason to expose the crew to the particular environment, that particular environment. It just did not seem reasonable when I could steam a few hundred miles further south and have a much more pleasant environment. I guess that's it. No, I don't believe so. Again, I believe the weather conditions were adequate, but there were better ones further south, and the fact is you shoot for the best.
Yeah. Who's going to be flying the reentry tomorrow, McDivitt or Scott?
Gene Inslee.
Yeah, I think that's basically it. I believe it's going to be the GNN system. I'm sure that, Jim's over. Jim probably will be doing it. I haven't let, if you want the honest God truth, I haven't looked at it from that standpoint.
On that GNN reentry, is that essentially the same or a simulation of the lunar trajectory reentry? Do we go through the double hump routine as before, or is this just a straight drop?
No, sir. This is you don't even get into the guidance system, the part of the guidance that you do on your lunar. This is just a plain one buildup of G, and then it gets up, like I said, about 3.2 max G. And that's all. And that's right at the end of flights, right then about in the blackout.
Yeah, I got that.
Somebody said that the only other time you've moved a landing point in a previous flight because of weather was Gemini 5. Is that correct to your memory? Or?
Great. I was asked this question earlier today, and to the best of my recollection, I believe we moved it. In fact, Jack, I believe, is the one that asked it.
Yeah.
I believe we
moved
it
one rev
earlier.
In 5.
Yeah. You cut it short one revenue earlier. Yeah.
John may have more information.
Do you remember, John, if there's any other mission where, to your knowledge, we brought it down either a rev earlier or a rev later? I guess, Jim, and I ain't. That's just what I was going to say.
Yeah. I can see, I don't know about a rev, but we have moved it back and forth. In fact, for Apollo 7, we had 67 degrees west and 64 right up until 4 hours before reentry. But for the same rev, of course.
Looks like this will be the last reentry from Earth orbit for quite a while. Maybe you going to try to get anything extra out of it?
Nope. I think we've got as much as we need. What we need is a good reentry.
You have Mr. Lannon's answer yet?
You give us some kind of ETA for the Gulf Stream here at Ellington.
We don't have one yet, as far as I know, do we? A Gulfstream ETA at Ellington?
Mid-afternoon Friday.
Yeah, that's as close as we can get. Go ahead.
Gene, going back to your pre-flight predictions that if you got everything accomplished that you set out to accomplish, you'd be 150% successful.
Boy.
And looking at the little extras that you've given us today, are you...
200%, is that what you're trying to say?
Could you put some kind of tag on it like that?
Boy, like I say, it's a function of my opinion versus what we said we were going to do. And I guess the best thing to do is to say we did what we said we were going to do and then close my mouth thereafter.
John Lannon gets the last question.
He never gives me the other kinds. That's why. The last 5 days of the flight, from the viewpoint of looking at the day-to-day flight plan, it looked like a real dead scene, and you've sort of cobbled a flight plan up daily on a real-time basis. Now, what do you think you've wrung out of this 5 days beyond proving that this spacecraft is going to keep on flying almost as long as you'd like it to fly?
I think we've always had, and in fact you saw some of the problems we ran into. For instance, we tried a planetary alignment, we had problems. We had several problems. What we were trying in many of these cases were backup or alternate procedures that had never been tried in flight before. And we have been using those almost consistently from the 5th through the 9th days, actually for the last 4 days. And it's one thing to demonstrate that a procedure is going to work on the ground. It's another thing to prove that it works in the air, particularly when you find that you don't have all the proficiency in these procedures you may expect. Okay, your primary, your most important, your crew safety type procedures are the ones that you develop the proficiency in. Many of these support or satellite procedures, way second and third order backup type procedures, you never have the opportunity to acquire proficiency in. I think what we learned is that, one, these procedures do work, and secondly, if the guys have a good knowledge of how the system operates, both in the spacecraft and the ground, you can acquire proficiency very rapidly in many of these alternate or backup procedures. So I think that's one of the things that we learned in the last 4 days. In fact, I think it's one of the major items we learned.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.